From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two views on the Iranian threat. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House pushing the case that Iran needs to be stopped soon from building the bomb. President Obama insisting there is still time to avoid a conflict. Time for diplomacy pressure. Both men insisting that the alliance between Washington and Tel Aviv is as strong as ever. Big choices to be made about what comes next. This hour on Point, the U.S., Israel, and what to do about Iran. Joining me first in the studio today is David Sanger. He's the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. David, welcome back to On Point. Good to see you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
So here we are, U.S. and Israel at this moment, with all the tension and pressure that we feel in the air, agreeing to kind of disagree. I mean, President Obama is saying more time. Netanyahu is saying time is running out.
Yes, but I thought it was interesting what Prime Minister Netanyahu did not say. He did not talk about red lines. He did not give specific deadlines. The American officials who I've talked to in the past 24 hours say that the actual conversation in the Oval Office didn't really focus all that much on the military option. It talked about all of the options in between, what you could do next in sanctions, what kind of covert action might buy some more time. So, you know, there's sort of two levels to this conversation. There's a political conversation that's underway, which gets a little bit overheated in a campaign season and when people are giving speeches in front of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, as both President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu did. And then there's the real conversation that takes place at not only the president and prime minister's level, but the levels underneath.
Here's Netanyahu yesterday talking with the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. This is last night in Washington.
My friends, Israel has waited, patiently waited, for the international community to resolve this issue. We've waited for diplomacy to work. We've waited for sanctions to work. None of us can afford to wait much longer. As Prime Minister of Israel, I will never let my people live in the shadow of annihilation.
The message there of the Israeli Prime Minister before AIPAC. Here was the President of the United States on Sunday before the same group.
Iran's leaders should have no doubt about the resolve of the United States. Just as they should not doubt Israel's sovereign right to make its own decisions about what is required to meet its security needs. I have said that when it comes to preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, I will take no options off the table. And I mean what I say.
David Sanger of the New York Times with me in the studio. So help us here, David. I mean, we're watching this, and the kind of comments that come out make you feel as though, who knows, Israeli jets could be in the sky, you know, next week or a week after next or any time, headed for Iran in all those targets, and there are many, and they are deep, and they are hard, many of them at this point, to get at. But you say that's public posturing?
I think it's beyond posturing. And clearly, the Israelis have a plan for this. Clearly, the United States has a plan for this. You couldn't go into a situation like this without an active military plan. However, there is an element of posturing. And the element of posturing is that if the Israelis do not – if they let up the pressure, they believe, then the world community will not focus on the sanctions, on getting serious about this, about getting the Chinese – to understand that they would have more to lose from disruption in the Gulf than they would from reducing oil
purchases.
Stick
with the sanctions, or you may be looking at war in your major oil source.
So, and that is not to say that this is bluffing. I think that when Prime Minister Netanyahu says he may well have to act, he may well have to act. But before he does, he's got two big calculations to make out here. And the first is, would he know, and would the United States know, if Iran's program took a turn away from where it is right now and toward a race for a bomb? And second, if it did that, Tom, would attacking from the air be the most effective way to buy delay? And remember, we're only talking about buying delay here. There is no option that I hear about that anybody is discussing in the United States or in Israel that would actually stop the program. You can't wipe out the knowledge in people's heads about how to build a weapon, which is why you heard the president say in his speech on Sunday that the only effective way to get countries to give up nuclear weapons permanently is to have them come to a political decision that the weapons aren't worth it.
Is there a meeting of minds between Israel and the United States on that point? Netanyahu sounded much more bellicose on that point rather than sort of, oh, let's persuade them.
I think the difference is that for Netanyahu, a delay of 3 or 4 years may well be worth it. And when the Americans look at this, they say, well, supposing you do this bombing, you have retaliation from Iran, you drive the Iranian program further underground. Mm-hmm. You unify the opposition in Iran behind the mullahs because they've been attacked from the outside. Is that worth the additional few years you buy?
Netanyahu's—you're saying he may believe that with a military attack he could buy 3 or 4 years, and the Americans say—
Yeah. Netanyahu, I think everybody's in agreement that you probably wouldn't buy a whole lot more than that, although the Israelis make the point that— they ended up buying more time with the attack on the Osirak reactor in Iraq in 1981 and then the Syrian reactor in 2007 than people thought they would.
Though it should be noted that some years later, the entire United States was pulled into war with Iraq on exactly the charge that that program was back and in gear.
And we know it wasn't back and in gear. But in the interim, the Iraqis did make a fair bit of progress before the Gulf War. But separate and apart from that, the key point here is the Israeli view is you set them back a few years, and if you have to go back and do it again later, you go back and do it again later. The American view is the cost is so high of doing an attack from the air that you've really got to think about whether the delay is worth it. And maybe there are other ways to get at this. More sanctions, more covert action.
That sounds like quite a canyon, that difference in perspective.
That's a pretty big canyon.
What are you suggesting when you raise the issue of the effectiveness of airstrikes on the Iranian nuclear program, that airstrikes just don't work or that they could or would indeed set things back for 3 or 4 years or that you need boots on the ground or slippers on the ground? I don't know.
I don't think boots on the ground are necessarily going to, you know, make a big difference here. And I don't know anybody who believes they would. The central problem with an airstrike is the facility at Goum, which is the one that the president and the British prime minister and the French president revealed the existence of in 2009. It had been known by the United States for 2 or 3 years before that and by Israel. That is under about 250 feet of granite. No one believes the Israelis have the bunker-busting capability to get down that deep.
Does the U.S.?
There is some question about whether the U.S. has that ability, and there is debate about whether or not the explosions that you would cause on the top of that facility would do as much damage
wreck what's under.
Underneath.
Mm-hmm. Who decides? Prime Minister Netanyahu made much of two things. One, you know, that the U.S. and Israel are essentially their interests are the same, he asserted. We are, what did you say, something like, you know, we are you and you are us. Talk about, overlapping the two countries' interests. We'll look at whether they are overlapping quite so directly. But who decides? If Israel goes, does the U.S. have a sign-off on that? Does it just sit back? Did Obama say no in that private meeting at the White House? Can he?
I don't think the United States has a sign-off. The president said explicitly, you played a clip of that saying this is Israel's own decision. But what the Israelis know is that they would rather go with the United States for the reason we just discussed. They simply don't have the capability to get down that deep at the facility they care about the most.
Is that effectively a sign-off then?
Well,
If the U.S. won't promise to come in behind them or support them as they do it, then it's ineffective and they don't have the option.
I think it's a little more complex than that, Tom, because I think the Israelis believe that sooner or later the U.S. would get involved in this conflict, that if the Israelis went in alone, the Iranians would then respond. The Iranians would probably believe the U.S. was involved in some way in the attack, at least in providing intelligence, that eventually the U.S. would get sucked in, perhaps because some Iranian captain out in the Strait of Hormuz took a shot in an American ship. And these are all scenarios that the White House has ordered up the Pentagon to go think through with great care.
So who's in the driver's seat here? If the U.S. would be pulled in, if that's Israel's calculation, and they may well be right, Who's driving this? Is Tel Aviv ultimately deciding, because they can go and buy that, Israel, the U.S. gets pulled in? Is it really in their hands, or does Obama somehow, does the White House somehow?
That's what this complex dance between the prime minister and the president that you've seen taking place. And before this meeting, Tom Donilon, the national security advisor, going out to Israel and spending a fair bit of time with Prime Minister Netanyahu, that's what this is all about. And the prime minister, I'm sure, is calculating that in an election year, President Obama would have very little choice but to back Israel to the hilt.
All three Republican, top Republicans, Romney, Santorum, Gingrich, speaking to AIPAC today, and all of them saying Obama's not hard enough here.
Everyone but Ron Paul, whose view is that the Iranians should be left alone. So I think the political calculation is such that Netanyahu is probably thinking that if he needs to get U.S. support, he might have a better shot before the election than after.
Boy, that puts it right in front of us. David Sanger with the New York Times. It's very good to have you right here. We're talking this hour about the U.S., Israel, and the way ahead on Iran. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the U.S., Israel, and the way ahead on Iran. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, is with us, the author of The Inheritance, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. The president and Prime Minister Netanyahu at the White House yesterday before their private conversation, a kind of photo op with remarks. Here's President Obama on the dangers of a Middle East nuclear arms race.
We all know that it's unacceptable from Israel's perspective to have a country with a nuclear weapon that has called for the destruction of Israel. But as I emphasized yesterday, it is profoundly in the United States' interest as well to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. We do not want to see a nuclear arms race in one of the most volatile regions in the world.
And here, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, sitting next to the President of the United States, stressing the close relationship between the two countries.
Americans know that Israel and the United States share common values, that we defend common interests, that we face common enemies. Iran's leaders know that too. You know, for them, you're the great Satan, we're the little Satan. For them, we are you, and you are us. And you know something, Mr. President? At least on this last point, I think they're right. We are you, and you are us. We're together.
The Israeli Prime Minister yesterday. Let me bring in a couple of more voices here. David Sanger, stand by. From Cambridge, Massachusetts, Graham Allison joins us, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School, served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration, special advisor to the Defense Secretary under President Reagan. And I'll note that Graham co-teaches with David Sanger, a course at Harvard called Central Challenges in American National Security and the Press. Graham Allison, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleased to be with you.
And with us from Washington is Michael Makowski. He's Foreign Policy Director at the Washington Think Tank, the Bipartisan Policy Center, heads the organization's Iran Project, worked at the Pentagon during the George W. Bush administration on Iraq issues and for the Coalition Provisional Authority. His recent op-ed in the Weekly Standard is headlined The Red Line for Iran. It's at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Makowski, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
Graham Allison, we heard the Israeli Prime Minister saying there, we are you and you are us. We're together. Is that true?
No. I'd say in one word, it's a good line for Netanyahu, and he would like to try to cast his conception of the Iranian challenge as essentially similar to the American challenge, but I think the American conception of the challenge, I think that in the private conversation, David got it exactly right. I suspect that it was clear that the differences between Netanyahu and Obama are greater than the similarities. And I could go through the list of a dozen, but let me just start from the top. Has Iran decided to make a nuclear bomb? U.S. view, no. Netanyahu, yes. Is there an opportunity for sanctions and diplomacy to stop Iran short of a nuclear bomb? Netanyahu, no. Obama, yes. Is an airstrike, either by Israel or Iran, likely to solve the problem Netanyahu somehow thinks maybe Obama know that, as David said, it could set things back for several years, but almost certainly will solidify a determination to get a nuclear bomb. And Iran has already passed the most significant threshold in this story, namely it's acquired the know-how and technology for making a nuclear bomb itself if it decides to do that privately, secretly. So in terms of the drama that's playing out now over the next, over the course of the election season, Netanyahu was attempting to press Obama to his conception of the problem. Obama, I don't think, moved at all. And it's even more complicated, just if I do one more leg quickly, that if you said who's on Obama's side and who's on Netanyahu's side of the analysis of this issue, on the one side you have Obama, you have Netanyahu, and you have the Republican presidential candidates, and lots of the, I mean, I'd say APEC, if you took a vote, would vote with Netanyahu. On the Obama side of this, you have the U.S. intelligence community, the U.S. military establishment, the Israeli intelligence community, and the Israeli military establishment. So it's a very interesting picture here as you do the layers of the complexity.
Michael Makovsky, if we've got the U.S. intelligence and military establishment saying, don't go fast toward war here or a strike, if they're saying no, why would or should the U.S. do it?
That's a good question. I think that given what happened with the Iraq war, where the intelligence community, you know, said it was a slam dunk, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, I think it'd be highly unlikely in the near term for the intelligence community to say Iran had nuclear weapons unless there was an unequivocal smoking gun. And frankly, I think that it's a very hard thing to do. We've never really predicted when a power has tested for the first time, and it's very hard to predict ahead of time when they've actually put on the screws and actually finalized the a nuclear weapon.
So you're saying they're just gun-shy? They're afraid to say that Iraq may have a nuclear weapon? Is our intelligence community come to that? And what about Israel's? Graham Allison says they, too, military and intelligence communities, do not favor a rapid strike.
Yes. I mean, I think there's I think there are two issues about our intelligence community. Again, I think that one, I think there is a certain gun shyness, and given what happened with the Iraq war. And secondly, again, I think it's a very difficult red line of saying, you know, that we'll know when they actually develop an actual weapon, when they're denying us international inspectors to facilities and so on. Regarding the Israeli intelligence, I'd say it's a little more nuanced than Graham says. I know he's referring to the former head of the Mossad saying, you know, be dumb for Israel to strike. On the other, I think there's actually more divisions within the military intelligence community and the Mossad on this issue, as far as I understand. I think there's partly some institutional issues. You know, the intelligence folks, the covert folks, thinks they could take care of this. There's also some political issues between the former head of the Mossad and the current prime minister of Israel. So I think you have those sort of things. But there's no question that there's not I agree with Graham that there is not unanimity in the Israeli establishment on this issue.
In that case, you have said, Michael, to us that you think chances are pretty high that Israel will strike Iran this year before the U.S. elections. If there's not unanimity, there are downside issues here, then there's the threat side. Why do you think Israel will do that? Why do you think chances are high they'll do it without unanimity, in the face of apparently some resistance from U.S. intel and military?
Right. Well, for any of those of us who's worked in government, we see in the U.S. government, you're never going to have complete unanimity on anything. Ultimately, this is a political decision. I believe when Menachem Begin attacked the Iraqi reactor, Sirach, in 81, there were also divisions within the cabinet and in the intelligence community even then, and that's been seen as widely successful since Iraq has not been able to have a nuclear program, a nuclear weapon in those 30 years. Why I think there's high, because the Israelis are obviously very reluctant to do it. I don't think they've made a decision to do it. They'd obviously rather not do it because they recognize the negative cost to a strike. And there is some uncertainty whether it will be successful. That said, I think their view still is that we're getting very close to nuclear weapons capability, that their concern, the administration has made clear, it seems like, in the near term, a military option is off the table in the near term. And even if it's on the table broadly, and I think they're worried what they call the zone of immunity, when they think a military strike by them will no longer be successful and that the Iranians will enjoy some immunity from attack, at least from Israel. They've indicated Ehud Barak, the defense minister, who is not known for bluster, has suggested that window, that zone of immunity, could begin later this year. So I think that would be their calculation if they decide to strike.
David, I want to bring it to you, but Michael, do you think could Israel strike without support from the United States? Do they need, in effect, some kind of American sign-off to saying, help you clear airspace, or could they literally do it on their own, or does it require American cooperation?
Well, you've raised two good issues in that question. I think that they certainly convey, if you talk to senior Israeli generals, they'll convey to you that they feel they can do it. And I think we have to, assume that they mean it. They've been planning on this for many years. They couldn't certainly, as other guests said, as Graham and David said, they couldn't do a job like the United States could do. But they could do the job. And in terms of what would most likely happen if they decide to do it would be, they wouldn't ask for U.S. permission because they know that they won't be granted that. They would probably alert the president, like as the planes are about to take off the ground, and ask them to alert the commanders in the area, not to interfere. What the military term is like, deconfliction of forces.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the minimum the Israelis would seek, and I think the U.S. would certainly comply with that.
David Sanger, what's your view here from what you've learned? Could Israel land a blow worth going into conflagration or conflict without U.S. support?
Could they land a blow? Yes. Could they delay the program? Yes. Is it worth it? That's a political judgment. It's not a military judgment.
Why do you say political? Because surely it's not worth opening this can of worms unless you can at least push this back by some years. Is it really political? That makes it sound like the whole thing would be grandstanding, but we're talking about real interest here and blowback.
I mean political in the small p use of the word. That, in other words, a country would have to weigh its longer-term interests against the gain that they would get from the strike. And I think Graham and David played out what those interests are. And the difficulty is that the United States and Israel view those interests differently. The Israelis say that they are living much closer to the threat. They're within Iranian missile range. And therefore, they have much less margin for error.
But they could land a significant blow without U.S. support?
They could land a significant blow. Now, but the question is, are you here to get a delay or are you here to get a solution to the problem? And if you're here to get a delay, which is, I think, what everybody everybody's in agreement here, then you have to say, okay, is the best way to get a delay through this kind of strike? Is it through a deniable covert action? I mean,
Stuxnet,
think of last year, Stuxnet, 2010. We saw the Iranians get slowed down some. The estimates differ, but some people believe it probably set them back a year and a half. Now, that was without having to suffer much blowback.
We're talking different terms now, Graham Allison. I want to bring this to you. Let me get the callers in here. Omaha, Nebraska. William is calling. Hi, William. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say that going back to what Netanyahu said about America and Israel sharing common interests, I, along with some of your guests, don't think that that is really the case at all. We need to stop being Israel's tool. Iran is their problem because they are committing ethnic cleansing in the occupied territories, and Iran will not stand for that, and I don't think we should either. If we were to get ourselves involved in another conflict in the Middle East, we would be spreading our already small resources even thinner, and I don't think that that is wise for any reason whatsoever.
William, I appreciate your call. I mean, you're calling Israel's relationship or handling of Palestinians ethnic cleansing. I'm sure many of Israel certainly would disagree with that. But, Graham Allison, this comes back to interests and where they lie. And maybe the downsides for the U.S. of getting into this conflict if we don't absolutely have to. But then the definition of when we have to may be different for the United States and Israel, Graham.
You're just right. I mean, I think no two countries have identical interests. It certainly is the case that the U.S. has a huge overlap of interest with Israel, given shared values and given the longstanding relationship. So Israel is one of our closest allies. Mm-hmm. But in the same way that there's differences between the interests of France and the U.S., of course there's differences among countries. That's number one. Number two, with respect to the challenge of Iran, as David said earlier, Israel is closer to the problem, more fearful, and lives in a small state in which one nuclear bomb could make Israel a basically uninhabitable place. Mm-hmm. So as they conceive it, it's an existential threat. Three, they've gone through this experience of the Holocaust, and so particularly for somebody like Netanyahu, this is a nightmare. And when he goes home and talks to his father, who's now, like, I think, about 100 years old, his father tells him, do not let this happen. And he's thinking, oh, my God, I hope this doesn't happen. I pray this doesn't happen. And in any case, if there's anything I can do to prevent it from happening, I'm going to prevent it from happening. So he has more tolerance for the notion of a war than Obama does. As the thing that was spinning around the internet last week said, if you like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you're going to love war with Iran. So the U.S.
What's the implication of that? What is the implication of that, Graham?
Well, I would say that the U.S. is going to be as reluctant as possible to go to war, reasonably, particularly when there's a reasonable chance that there's an alternative that will prevent Iran getting a nuclear bomb. And even, and this is where Obama struck a very interesting new note, I thought, even offers the possibility of a long-term solution.
You say as reluctant as possible, but what determines that possibility? Is it determined by Iran's actions or by Israel's?
I would say this is I've written about this separately as a Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion. So in the missile crisis 50 years ago, we saw these two parties in 13 days come to a crossroad. This is one which is going over months, but there's three parties playing, just as you said. There's not just the U.S., and there's not just Iran. There's Israel, and so you've got this three-party game going in which there's a little bit of bluffing of each other. There's some differences of view. There's no question that Israel can act unilaterally if it chooses to do so, but not very effectively. No question that Israel would prefer that the U.S. act militarily, but I think that Obama signaled very clearly that as long as he believes it's possible to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb without going to war, he's going to work that possibility.
It leaves us wondering, though, if it's finally in his hands. Graham Allison, please stand by. David Sanger, Michael Makovsky. We're talking about the U.S., Israel, and the way ahead on Iran. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Lots of response online, and Michael, Graham, David, I have to say there's a lot of resistance here. People saying, you know, this is getting scary. Dwight writes on Facebook, if this gets out of control, I don't have much faith, he writes, that, and he fears it will get out of control, judging by all the rhetoric. The consequences, he says, will be enormous. A listener online says, if you think our recent wars were unpopular, just wait till the American people, who have not been paying attention to this yet, suddenly hear we're going to war with a serious country like Iran. This listener writes, support Israel, yes, but what kind of ally has Israel really been to the USA? Where's the peace deal we told them we needed them to ink with the Palestinians. What about that piece of this? David Singer, we talked with Stephen Walt earlier because he's thought a lot about and written controversially about the Israeli lobby, U.S. foreign policy. He said, you know, Netanyahu sees Iran as an existential threat and the Palestinians as a problem to be managed. He says Obama sees the Palestinians as the existential threat ultimately for Israel, and if that problem is not resolved, and Iran is the problem to be managed. Now, here's the Israeli prime minister saying, work with us, United States. Here's a terrible threat. When President Obama asked for Israel's cooperation on the Palestinians, he got kind of the back of the hand from the same prime minister.
He did. And when, you know, on the issue of settlements, obviously, they've had a lot of differences. The last time that Prime Minister Netanyahu was in the United States and in the Oval Office, you may remember he lectured the president in
public. Dressed him down, yeah.
Right. Now, there was a big effort to make sure that didn't recur this time. But I think the answer to your question, Tom, comes back to something that Graham said before when he talked about overlapping but not completely congruent interests. If the president of the United States comes to the determination that the U.S. has to take military action, and he left that open as his sort of last and final option in his speech.
Iran will not have nuclear weapons. Right. Containment is not where we're headed, he said.
If he does that, he has to justify that completely on the basis of American interests, of which Israel and the alliance with Israel is a part, but not the whole nature of it. And when you go back and look at his speech to AIPAC on Sunday, and I was in the back of the room because I just wanted to sort of measure what the reaction to him was, I thought one of the most interesting parts of the speech was when he said, Iran not getting a bomb is in the profound security interests of the United States as opposed to simply the security interests of Israel. So that's where the decision gets difficult for President Obama, and it's why there should be no surprise that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama have sort of different triggering mechanisms in their own mind about when that moment would come.
Well, here's the president at that meeting on Sunday where you were in the back of the hall saying, he'll speak for himself.
Iran's leaders should understand that I do not have a policy of containment. I have a policy to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And as I have made clear time and again during the course of my presidency, I will not hesitate to use force when it is necessary to defend the United States and its interests.
And that has been demonstrated. On the other hand, he said, there is too much loose talk of war.
Already there is too much loose talk of war. Over the last few weeks, such talk has only benefited the Iranian government by driving up the price of oil, which they depend on to fund their nuclear program. For the sake of Israel's security, America's security, and the peace and security of the world, now is not the time for bluster.
Don't bluster. But last night, before that same group, the AIPAC conference, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said Iran must be stopped, and he's pushing urgency here on the nuclear front.
I want you to think about what it would mean to have nuclear weapons in the hands of these radicals who lead millions of people in chants of death to America and death to Israel.
And it gets you thinking. Let's go to our listeners. Iowa City, Shams is calling. Shams, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is the U.S. going to be an agent for peace or an agent for a preemptive war? We've had enough wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to focus on our own internal and external interest. And even though Israel is our best ally, I'm not sure that encouraging or supporting Israel in attacking another sovereign country that did not attack it is for its own best.
Shams, now, Iran says it's not developing nuclear weapons, but there is deep skepticism about that. If you talk about being an agent for peace, what if Iran is well on its way to developing nuclear weapons? Is there a peace-seeking role for the United States in trying to stop that?
You know, this is a really interesting question. With North Korea having nuclear weapon, Israel having nuclear weapon, India, Pakistan. India doesn't even has not even signed up regarding limitation of the nuclear weaponry. The issue is, does Iran intend to use it for what reason? And to prove that need peaceful conflict resolutions and talking to what some consider our adversary.
Shams, we hear your impulse. The president, of course, already saying, you know, he's not willing to see if they intend to use it. Containment is not an option. He says, we'll see where this goes. I appreciate your call. Rashid in Tampa, Florida. Rashid, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. You know, we've been talking for months now as far as, like, how to bomb Iran, what to do, what weapons to use, what Israel would do, what America would do. But what we do not hear is how a real peace negotiation would look like. You know, we the peace negotiation we tried to offer was basically, here you go, Iran, you do what we tell you, and that is it. But, you know, a while back, the Brazilians and Turkish, they reached some sort of a negotiation with Iran about enrichment. And yes, it was not perfect, but why was not that used as a stepping stone to perhaps a real negotiation?
Rashid, we'll pick that up. There are headlines on that just today, and we'll talk about them in just a moment. I appreciate your call from Tampa very much. One more, and we'll bring it to our panel, Jonathan in Amherst, Massachusetts. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to ask all the panelists, what's your opinion about, it seems to me there's been a lack of organizing public opinion and public diplomacy in terms of looking at the Iranian regime. And you got a head of state who makes genocidal comments. You've got them being part of destabilizing Lebanon. You've got them, like, violently smashing their own people when they try to have a peaceful revolution. And you've got them also involved. They were directly involved, the Iranian regime, in a Hezbollah attack in Argentina in 1994. I happened to be in Israel the last time, summer of 94, when the Jewish community in Buenos Aires was the main central headquarters of the Jewish community was bombed by terrorists, and it turned out it was organized through Iran and Hezbollah.
Does that mean the United States should go to war with Iran, Jonathan?
No. I'm saying, what about public diplomacy and public opinion? I mean, you get people calling right now, you know, your listeners, and they're, of course, focused on how Israel oppresses the Palestinians, which is true, and how Israel has not, you know, gone along with the peace process under Netanyahu. But, you know, if we look at what the Iranian regime does worldwide and in the region, it's no comparison. That doesn't mean we should go to war. I think we should destabilize that government through massive public opinion, worldwide public opinion, to turn, you know, Russia and China into, you know, standing up against it in some way.
Jonathan, we've got it, though. David Sanger, I don't know exactly how much more the U.S. administration could do on that front. I mean, we've heard very, very loud cries from our representatives in the U.N. and beyond criticizing Russia and China. There's been a lot of work on public opinion. Certainly there's no shortage of criticism of Iran. This mobilization of public opinion one way or another, is that what's going on with, is that what we're in the middle of right here, David?
I don't believe that mobilization of public opinion is necessarily going to bring about what the ultimate objective here is, which is to stop Iran's progress toward a weapon or at least a weapons option. That said, you can't do this without having a lot of allies. And so when you think about President Obama's offer from his first days in office to negotiate unconditionally with the Iranians, what was that all about? One, I think it was sincere. But secondly, his own aides say to me, and they believe, that they could not have gotten this level of sanctions, which for the first time had begun to bite.
Pretty remarkable level, yeah.
Right. Much further than the sanctions that President Bush was able to get through. And they believe that they could not have gotten that if there wasn't a bona fide offer to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, just this morning, the European allies and the United States have announced that they are going to accept another letter, highly conditional, from the Iranians to come back and negotiate, and they'll meet them to negotiate. And that is all about keeping this whole group of countries together, including China and Russia.
Unified front.
Now, have China and Russia been together completely? No. But certainly the Chinese and the Russians have been a lot more active in the past couple of years than they have before. The Russians declined to sell the Iranians an anti-aircraft system. The Chinese have begun to cut back on their purchase of Iranian oil in their own interest.
Mm-hmm. Graham Allison, our caller Rashid in Tampa asks, what would real negotiations look like? Now, of course, that it takes two to tango. Iran has, you know, sort of played rope-a-dope here many times. Now, as David Sanger says, there's an offer again to talk about this. Is there something, you know, if the alternative is war that would have big downside consequences as well, Is there some different kind of conversation that somehow we haven't fallen to yet in trying to talk this away, Graham?
Well, I think Rashid has had a very good question, and I think one of the things that's been missing in the package has been a yesable proposition to Iran. The U.S. and the international community have come to Iran over and over with maximalist demands, which Iran won't accept, and therefore there's no agreement. But I think actually there's a germ of an agreement building. I think the pressure that the U.S. and allies have been putting on Iran is raising the cost for them of pursuing the program that they're on. But we've got to give them a way out at some point. And I think the way out would be, the hint of it was in a speech that Ahmadinejad gave in New York in September when he was at the General Assembly, in which basically Iran would agree to roll back all enrichment of uranium to 5%, which is the level at which you make enrichment for fuel.
Not weapons grade.
Not weapons grade.
Not even close.
Mm-hmm. They're currently building, they're currently manufacturing 20% enriched uranium, mm-hmm. which is way, way, way towards nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. 90% is what you want for bombs, but mm-hmm. 20%,
again, you're on your way.
The whole point is 90% of the way. It just turns mm-hmm. out it's not linear.
Yep.
So if we were able to reach an agreement with Iran to go back to 5% enrichment as a bright red line, and if there were going to be huge punishments, including the risk of the threat of military action, if they should breach that line, which they proposed and which they had agreed to, I think you've got something that President Obama said in an interview this weekend, you know, basically pushing them further down the field away from a bomb. And it's not a comfortable place for them to be, but the unfortunate fact is that they've been enriching uranium since 2006. They know how to enrich uranium. Mm-hmm. They know how to make centrifuges. They've mm-hmm. crossed yep. all sorts of red lines that are horrible for them to have crossed, but they've crossed them. So the idea of erasing those facts is not realistic.
But maybe a germ there. Michael Makovsky, I want to bring that to you. One more call, Dean in Medford, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you. Listen, timing is everything, and if Israel is going to do it, they're going to want to do it at the maximum, or at the time when they have maximum leverage, and that's going to be about a month before the election, the American election. At that point, if he does nothing, that is, Obama does nothing, the Republicans will crucify him and he'll lose the election. If he does something, maybe he's got a chance to having the outpouring of yay, rah-rah that we've seen before. And
you think that would pull the U.S. in? That timing would make it?
Absolutely. A month, give or take, 2 weeks each way, either way.
Yeah, boy, timing everything. Dean, thanks for your call. Michael Makovsky, what about that? And what about the germ of an alternate path here? You know, Iran agrees to 5% enrichment, no more bright red line, and everybody can settle down here. Do you see that as a realistic possibility out there, Michael?
Yeah. If I can make, I'll address that. Let me make mm-hmm. one broad point first, is that I think we need to be clear. This isn't just about Israel. And I think the president has been very clear now with his rhetoric. This is U.S. interest.
Oh, we've played it all right here. He said
you did.
Yes, indeed. And he's on the record.
Oh, yeah. And I think the thing is, we all know from WikiLeaks, if we didn't know before, that I think the countries that are even more afraid of a nuclear Iran than Israel is our Arab allies, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the United Arab Emirates. And a nuclear Iran, if Iran became nuclear, they'd be the only OPEC country with nuclear weapons, and they would basically dominate, I think, the Persian Gulf.
But you can believe that and be determined to stop it and still see different paths for going forward. What about the germ of an alternate path to conflict here?
Yes. I think the genie is out of the bottle a bit with that in terms of where they are. As Graham said, they're already producing at 20% enriched uranium. And I think the way that the alternative route, I believe, for the U.S. is not as what Graham suggests, but it's actually, and this is something that we just put out a report at our office, the Bipartisan Policy Center, which included, several retired generals and admirals, which is that actually we think the United States needs to make, not just in rhetoric, but also in action, convey a more credible and visible military threat. Not because we want war, but we think that's the best way to get other countries to support our sanctions if they thought the alternative was war. It would also pressure the Iranians to negotiate in good faith. The last time the Iranians that we believe paused their nuclear program or their weaponization program was in 2003 to 2004 when they thought they were next after Saddam Hussein. So we think the best chance for getting a peaceful resolution is not what Graham said, but actually with action and rhetoric making clear that we mean what we say when we say all options are on the table.
We understand that dynamic. Of course, that can set up a kind of inevitability that Americans have seen unfold before. David Sanger, here we are. We're on the home stretch to a big election. The politics and leverage are sitting there. What do you see coming?
Well, I actually think we've probably got a few months at least before the Israelis would feel that they had to act. When you just take a look at what the Iranians have put together, the estimates that the U.S. and Israel agree on is that it would be at least a year before Iran could produce a weapon. What they disagree on is whether you would know for sure that that moment was coming.
And, of course, a few months would put us right in the heart of that election season that our caller points to.
You know, timing in life sometimes is everything.
Hang on to your hats. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times, thank you very much for being with us
today.
Great to
be with you, Tom.
Michael Makovsky at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Graham Allison at the Belfer Center, Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you, Graham.
Enjoyed the conversation.
This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.